Graham, welcome back to Full Story.
Thanks, Noah.
You're the Guardian's resident expert on climate and the environment. Are you bracing for a busy year of coverage as signs point towards a developing El Niño?
Yes, is the short answer. This developing El Niño, in headline terms, there's a chance that it gives us a much higher potential for a hottest year on record, probably next year, actually, 2027. There have been a lot of headlines already about this developing El Niño, some with some interesting words in them, like a mega El Niño or a super El Niño or a Godzilla El Niño, which was definitely a brand new one on me.
I didn't notice any of those terms in your reporting, Graham.
No.
Why?
Well, super and mega and definitely Godzilla, they're not really terms that the meteorologists would use. And also, that would be taking a bit of a gamble on what might eventuate, because we're not actually there yet, as far as El Niño goes. What we are looking at is what's going on in the tropical Pacific around the equator. And El Niño and La Niña, which is its sort of cooler, wetter cousin, brother, sister, that's part of a natural cycle that goes on there. But it can have global ramifications depending on what phase this thing is in. It's called the El Niño Southern Oscillation. So we are watching it really super closely.
So just earlier this month, the World Meteorological Organization released its latest update, and essentially it reaffirmed what others had been forecasting and warned of a moderate to possibly strong El Niño later this year. How do they reach a decision like that?
Yeah, good question. So, I mean, I was reporting on a potential El Niño whatever strength back in February. So what they're looking at there is, firstly, we have to sort of a quick ENSO 101. So what we're looking at is an area in the tropical Pacific around the equator. We look at what the sea surface temperatures are. And if they go above a certain threshold, that is for the Bureau of Meteorology, it's 0.8 degrees centigrade above average. But then the Bureau of Meteorology, it also looks for other things as well. So it's looking at what are the trade winds doing? They usually blow east to west. Are they a bit weaker or are they even reversing? Are there changes in clouds? Is the atmosphere sort of coupling, they call it, with what's going on the ocean surface? So the Bureau likes to see that, and it hasn't quite seen it yet. But the latest temperature readings from that region as of a couple of days ago has us just creeping in to that 0.81 degrees above average. So the ocean surface is definitely sort of showing strong signs that we're heading into an El Niño. But you asked about strength. And this is a general rule of thumb, right? Is you get up to a degree hotter than usual in that part of the Pacific, that's an El Niño. It's generally a weak El Niño. 1 to 2 degrees, that's a moderate El Niño. Anything above 2 degrees generally is seen as being quite a strong El Niño. But what's really important here is that, firstly, for Australia, when we talk about El Niño giving us these drier and hotter conditions, that's a lot more pronounced in winter and spring than it might be in summer. And for Australia, a strong El Niño doesn't necessarily mean really strong impacts. For countries that are closer to the action, a bit closer to the equator and around the Pacific, a strong El Niño for them will mean some really strong impacts.
So it does affect different parts of the world in different ways. And before we talk about Australia, could you give us a global snapshot of what could happen?
So globally, as far as temperatures go, it generally pushes temperatures up. And climate scientists are expecting that there's a good chance that 2027 probably will be the hottest year on record. But around the world, yeah, an El Niño affects places differently. So we see like an increase in the drought and the heat risk for sort of southern Central Africa, India, South America, including the Amazon, and obviously for Australia too. But then we can also see sort of high risk of flooding, like the Middle East, South and Central Asia, parts of the US. California is probably eyeballing an El Niño and hoping that that it gets a lot more rain because it's been very dry there. So yeah, an El Nino can have knock-on effects pretty much all around the globe.
For some people in Australia, the idea of a slightly drier winter might be welcome. What are the consequences for Australia if this does arrive?
For winter in Australia, quite large parts of the east of the country is probably going to get drier than usual conditions. And also the minimum temperatures are going to be higher than usual and the maximum temperatures are going to be higher than usual. So dry might be welcome for some. Maybe if you're a ski resort, maybe not, because that might mean lower snowfall. Generally, the long-range forecast seems to be lining up with what we might expect from an El Nino as well, which is warmer minimums, warmer, hotter maximums, and probably drier. That can also have knock-on consequences for animals and plants that are used to a particular season and seeing things go a particular way and it doesn't. And maybe if you like skiing, you should maybe perhaps hang around for those big wintry blasts to come through.
Graham, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he used very direct language when the UN agency released its latest update. And he said, the science is clear. The world must treat it as an urgent climate warning. El Nino conditions will pour fuel on the fire of a warming world. How does El Nino interact with climate change?
And El Nino now is coming on in a planet that's about 1.5 degrees warmer than it used to be. So the impacts that we might expect to see from El Nino are kind of being supercharged, if you will, by global heating. And that's really important. So when I talked about how an El Nino generally can give us record temperatures globally, a La Nina would usually give us cooler temperatures, but the La Niñas that we are getting now are warmer than the El Niños that we were getting just a few decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole planet is warming. And we got to remember as well that El Niño is tied up with what's going on in the ocean. The oceans have taken up 90% of the extra heat due to us burning lots of fossil fuels and trapping extra energy in the atmosphere and in the Earth system. So when we get these impacts from El Nino, there's pretty much certainty that climate change is also there in the background, maybe supercharging some of them.
So what does that mean for climate-sensitive sectors like agriculture, health, energy and water?
Well, it means the same thing that climate change means. We've had variability in Australia and now we seem to be getting these quite big swings from dry periods that are drier and hotter than they used to be and then cooler and wetter periods. The cooler periods aren't getting us below average temperatures, but we're seeing an increase in big downpours and flooding. I mean, interestingly, the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia used to, only a few years ago, it would have an ENSO warning system and we used to write about this. Reporters used to write about the ENSO warning system. Are we on a La Nina watch? Are we on an El Nino watch? Where are we? But the Bureau has sort of changed the way that it communicates on this. And one of the reasons for that is that climate change is sort of what we have historically expected from La Niñas and El Niños. That might not be a good guide to what will happen in the future under La Niñas and El Niños, particularly in the agricultural sector. For example, you would have lots of farmers that would look ahead and go, well, El Nino coming or La Nina coming, and they will make some decisions based on past expectations of what's gone on. Now the Bureau says, we don't want to talk about El Nino and La Nina as much. What we want you to do is look at our long-range forecasts, because that's already considering what's happening with La Nina and El Nino anyway. But the climate change story does keep coming back.
The World Economic Forum said that governments, companies, aid agencies must prepare for what could prove to be a major systemic shock.
Mm.
And it says that El Nino should be seen as much of a public health threat as a climate hazard. What in practice does preparation mean? How do you prepare for that?
Well, you think about what would a really sharp and hot drought do to an industry in your country?
Mm.
So what might it do to your ability to grow crops or to run livestock? So there's big decisions that come from that. In the past, we've seen El Niños, for example, linked to famines.
Mm.
La Niña has caused sort of major flooding. Some of that can interfere with food supply chains. You know, so all this stuff has a knock-on effect. We're already seeing this sort of increased variability and increased weather extremes thanks to climate change. And we don't need a Godzilla El Nino or a super El Nino or whatever, you know, to deliver that. But then when an El Nino comes along on top, and we know that historically that has sort of tended to push temperatures up in some places and cause major flooding in others, you know, that I think what the World Economic Forum and the United Nations are trying to do there is sort of say, well, we're going into a new frontier here with climate change. And we know that in the past, El Nino has been problematic. And now you've got climate change layered on top of it, and that could make things worse. So get ready. For health agencies, for example, it might mean them thinking a bit more about how they warn the population about rising temperatures. What can they say to them about how to look after each other and themselves in heat waves, for example?
But this is just a couple of months away. Is that enough time? Should governments and agencies be well into their preparation for something like this?
Well, this is where we need to consider the warnings in the frame of what confidence did those climate models have. There's something called, in Australia, we call it the autumn predictability barrier.
Right, what's that?
When I was reporting about El Nino first back in February and March, I had experts saying, this is what we think might happen, but there's this autumn predictability barrier. It just means that the models, they can't be as confident in what the models are saying when they're delivering these forecasts for spring and summer, when they're delivered in the autumn. Because the Pacific is just this huge body of water. There's a lot that can go on. There's a lot that can change. So the experts are not as confident in what the models are telling them in February and March and April as they are in May and June and July. And so it's taken time for those models to line up. Like I remember looking at all the ranges of models like a month ago. And some of them were only just looking like we would have an El Nino, and others were looking scary hot. And it's still like that, except now all the models essentially are telling us that we're going to get an El Nino. And yes, some of them are showing incredibly warm temperatures in the tropical Pacific. That doesn't mean it's going to happen, though.
Mm. The forecasts are suggesting it's, you know, an 80 to 90% certainty that it will develop in the coming months. How long will it last?
Well, they often fade and we lose them in our sort of late summer, autumn. But that's probably pushing the model forecasts a bit too far out. But that's generally what we've seen in the past. But the effects can last quite a long time. Hence why if we get an El Nino that is declared in the coming weeks, that it will actually be 2027 when a lot of the climate experts think it's likely that would deliver us potentially all-time on record heat for the planet.
We'll be right back.